Yellen. She's the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. In her press conference,
the Federal Open Market Committee decided to raise the target range for the federal funds rate by 0.25 percentage point, bringing it to 0.75% to 1%. We've seen the economy progressing over the last several months in exactly the way that we anticipated. Core inflation has been little changed in recent months at about 1.75%. The median projection for growth of inflation-adjusted gross domestic product is 2.1% this year and next, and business sentiment is at favorable levels. Job gains averaged about 200,000 per month over the past 3 months, maintaining the solid pace we have seen over the past year.
What message are you trying to send consumers with this particular rate hike?
The simple message is the economy is doing well.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the Fed met this week, raising interest rates for the third time in 3 years, indicating that more rate hikes are to come. The market seemed to like the more dovish tone by the Fed. We actually saw stocks up this week, bond yields pulled back. Along with the dollar, we've got commodities on the rise, especially gold and silver. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up in hour one, John Murphy will be joining us as we talk about intermarket relationships and the sequence of events, how bull markets unfold, and how bear markets begin. We're going to be taking a look at some close correlations between interest rates, rising interest rates in stocks, which will surprise you, and then also the key role that commodities are going to play going forward in determining where the stock market is headed, as well as the economy. John will be joining me in hour one. Also, my good friend Don Cox will be here as we take a look at regime changes and other things and looking at the bigger macro pictures and its role that we've seen play out historically. All of that, along with Ryan Poplava, what moved the markets, all of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we've been doing a series here on the program as part of the big picture entitled Megatrends. We looked at 7 megatrends a couple of weeks ago that we thought would affect your life in the next 10 years and your investment strategies. We also said we needed separate shows for 2 additional megatrends. Last week, we talked about infrastructure. This week, the death of the bull market in bonds. The bond bull market is over. And what does that mean? Because normally bull markets go in cycles. So we'll look at exactly where we are in the cycle and then what the implications are going forward. Now, this week also the Fed met, and surprise, surprise, they're going to raise interest rates 0.25 percentage point, which puts the Fed funds rate at 1%. And by the way, this is where we were during the last rate raise cycle when we began it in 2004. So what does that mean as far as the economy is concerned and the markets? We know that they're going to continue raising rates. We don't know quite when, but also the market's reaction to the Fed's announcement seemed unusually strange, shall we put it that way? We'll discuss all of that today, coming up later on The Big Picture, right here at the Financial Sense News Hour. And down to my favorite Wall Street reporter, Ryan Poplava. I don't know, you've been demoted to a reporter there, Ryan Poplava, CEO of Poplava Financial Services. So let's see. I always start out by saying this has been really interesting. I guess it's good because it has been interesting over the last couple of months here. What we need is a wrap-up report on catalysts and drivers moving the financial markets this week. And Ryan, it really seems to me that the Fed, we had the announcement this week about another 0.25 percent bump. The Fed had the most influence, I would guess, on the market this week. So why don't we, if you would, summarize the Fed's decision and then the market's reaction to it on Wednesday. Let's start with that.
Sure, John. You know, I've heard just an oxymoron or two this week, like a dovish hike and benevolent raise, which to me was fairly comical in some of the stories that I read this week. But I think many didn't get that this wasn't an easing in policy. It was staying the course, which I think it was just leading up to this decision, just a real misconception ahead of it that essentially once we had the decision, that misconception and valuations in the market market were corrected. So with all of the Fed rhetoric in the past couple of weeks, the probability rose for a March hike. That became rather baked in the cake, as they say, and investors and analysts feared the Fed might change the estimated rate hikes in 2017 from 3, which is what we got last December, to 4. And that wasn't the case. What we had was the base case scenario of a rate hike of 25 basis points, the same projections for rates we saw in December, that of 3, a reiteration of the gradual glide path for rates, saying, okay, we're going to continue to raise rates, but it will be gradual. And finally, communication that suggests the Fed doesn't intend to shrink its balance sheet for some time. So, as such, investors corrected the misconception they had earlier that we were going to see this more hawkish development. And so there was a rally in bonds, there was a correction in the dollar, and there was a rally in commodities and stocks. So overall, I didn't read too much into the movements of just that one day, because as you've seen, Thursday and Friday, we've just kind of consolidated. We really didn't pile on that this just revolutionary changed the whole landscape. There are more interesting catalysts going on, John, than the Fed, in my opinion, like whether Europe changes its monetary policy stance or the UK, given the economic improvements there and just the political ramifications, possibly of a more populist movement in Denmark and more importantly in France. I think those are the areas that are more important to this market. But of course, we continue to get the same economic development continues. And as does earnings, we had Oracle came out this week, reiterated its earnings for the rest of the year and beat. So things look still, they continue to look positive for company earnings.
Going to be interesting with the elections in Europe because, of course, Herr Wilders didn't do as well as anticipated, leading the populist movement in the Netherlands. But it is by no means dead. And if things get worse, it may gain more steam. And as you said, we have Marine Le Pen in France, and there are other elections that are coming up. Denmark is going to be an issue. And of course, Angela Merkel this week. Chancellor Merkel was meeting with Donald Trump, President Trump, on Friday at the White House. So as details come out of their discussions, etc. Okay, now, if we look at the base case scenario, does this play a large effect, I guess is what I want to say, on what you are doing as portfolio managers and what you do?
Like I said, I don't think it really moved the needle too much on what we were anticipating. So as just portfolio managers, our allocation has been of the opinion that rates are headed higher. And so our fixed income portion has a low duration. It's a lot of the maturities are kept short and they're all in individual bonds. So we're not too worried about rates going up and the valuations dropping as these things mature. We get our money back. And that's mainly for conservative investors. On the equity side, you know, we're in cyclically sensitive positions. So given that the leading economic indicators continue to increase and the economic surprise indexes we follow are all wonderfully in positive territory. And obviously a lot of that is a lot of soft data, some hard data is cooked in there as well. Like I said, we're fairly bullish. We continue to be that way and continue to stance that way. But we do have a fixed income portion. As valuations get more expensive on Wall Street, an 18 times earnings, the projections for returns drop. So we start to take a more conservative stance as we approach those later stages in a bull market. But, you know, the Philly Fed survey came down some in March, looking at activity and news this week, but it held strongly above zero now for around 8 months. So overall economic activity continues to be steady, and that has been that way for some time. But interestingly, I have been following the Atlantic Fed's GDP tracker, and for the first quarter, estimates continue to drop. We're now at 0.9%, and that's not a great sign. You know, we want to continue to see that GDP is up, you know, more towards that 1.5-2% mark. So we're definitely watching that pretty closely, but definitely, you know, we don't have our pom-poms out completely. We are watching things, looking at valuations and trimming where we need to and adding to areas that we feel are there might be a rotation going into. But honestly, though, John, is slow growth and an extended bull market such a bad thing? I mean, that's kind of what we've had and what we've experienced. Typically, bull markets last 4 years. I mean, we're pretty long in the tooth here, but it's been slow growth. You know, we haven't had that 4% real overheated push in that we've had in 4 years in the past and then followed up by a bear market. You know, which would you prefer?
Why is it that when you said that, I had visions of you in a cheerleader's outfit? Yes, it was like, oh,
it's
I don't.
It's St. Patrick's Day on Friday, but
I don't need to go there. And I'm wearing green. I just want you to know at the same time.
So am I.
Yeah. All right, but when you put it that way, that's sort of the later stage. But the early years of the bull market, let's remember this. This was no fun with Europe's second recession and debt crisis, which ran from 2010 to 2013, right?
And pretty volatile time, yeah.
It was. And beyond the Fed, what do you think, though? I mean, we're at the Fed, and okay, we're committed to this course, but what are going to be the important catalysts that we should be focusing on long-term for investors in the coming months?
Overall, John, the policy decision this week was a major catalyst. It did move the markets. The S&P closed up nicely, up I think around 20 points, something around there. And it did play a part. So it's not putting things softly. It righted expectations that were more hawkish leading into it. But, you know, a return of growth economics and earnings and the return of fiscal policy to the table, I think those are the main catalysts that the market is really focusing on, with some attention, like I said, really being focused on the Republicans and Trump, looking at this partial budget proposal that was released this week and the appeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act, which is now going to the House for debate and a vote. I think how we see things play out between the different houses of Congress and Trump over the next month will really shed some light on the potential for some of the other big plans in tax reform and infrastructure later on. So that pretty much starts to really begin to kick off next week with that vote on the repeal and replace. And we're finally going to see where the rubber meets the road on the Trump administration and Republican Congress. If they can't get legislation through, then I think we have to take some of the gains in the stocks we've seen since Trump's phenomenal tax plan speech on February 8th. You know, some of that gain that we've seen there was predicated on, you know, some of the stuff being moved through. So some of the analysts we follow are pricing that into their strategies for the second half of this year. Maybe there's a disappointment. Maybe we get some things through here in the next couple of months. That will be a real telltale signal for what happens in fiscal policy. That's the real unknown right now.
Yeah, and when everybody talks about raising the debt ceiling, there was some chatter back when that this was going to be the line where we draw in the sand and this is it, we're not going to do anymore. And you and I know that's not going to happen. Just politically, it's not feasible. So this will go through without too much of a yawner, I think. Anything else happening this week that you would say of note? Anything the listeners, more importantly here, need to focus on, especially in the financial markets?
Well, overseas, I mentioned and you mentioned a little bit of what's going on politically in Europe. The French presidential debate will be on Monday. I don't know how many Americans will be watching that who listen to the show. But again, going into what's going on in Europe, we saw what happened to the UK last year. The populist vote here in the US with Trump being pushed in. You know, what's going on? Is there going to be a more conservative, or if things continue to go well economically, then maybe we don't see a Frexit vote, you know, France exiting the EU. That's on the table if there continues to be some real upset sentiment there. So looking at the debate, that'll be a key thing to watch next week. European markets will be watching it, definitely. And then it should be pretty quiet in the U.S., in which we continue to really anticipate a consolidation in stocks technically and bonds for the next few weeks until really mid-April, where we could get some economic news in early April. And then mid-April, we'll get the earnings season kicking off. And right before that, companies typically black out on their purchase programs just due to news being pending. So that tends to see a little bit of lull in activity in the markets. And then the March Flash Purchasing Managers Index data should be released, I think, next Friday. So that could potentially influence the economic landscape for just what's going on in March. Are things slowing? Are things stable? And we'll be watching that. And that's mainly for countries, U.S., Europe, and Japan. China isn't in there for the flash numbers. They're only in there for the end of the month. And finally, there will be the vote in the House. As I mentioned, Paul Ryan's healthcare bill coming through for an actual vote, went through the Ways and Means Committee already. The Washington Post article on Friday, one of the headlines I read said, if they can't do it now, Republicans can probably kiss healthcare reform goodbye. So it's not just the healthcare reform that's getting its pulse checked. It's also the rest of the Republicans' platform. So there's quite a bit riding on this bill next week for the Republicans. They're really trying to push it as quickly as possible. No minority debates. The issue is that, according to the Washington Post, 70 Republicans have expressed concerns about the bill. And if they're trying to speed things along, they have a lot of lobbying to do because they will need at least 218 votes. That leaves only, I think, 21 votes that they could lose and two in the Senate. So that's what's on their plate. And I'm assuming that we don't get any Democratic votes, or at least the Republicans don't.
You know, it's interesting in looking at this bill, because what should have happened originally back in 2008 is we should have had a robust public debate about it and some serious planning. Instead, we fired off the starter's pistol in May. And I remember Nancy Pelosi saying we were going to have it done by House recess in August. And of course, the whole country just erupted into panic and furious. Well,
she said, let's pass it so we know what it does.
And it finally got to that point, right? And so that was the wrong thing in the first place. We needed healthcare reform. This was not reform. This was a whole new program built on socialist models, you know, and it's already got its problems with its own unsustainability. The problem now, so I guess lesson one is you need to understand the name of the game in politics is putting the football over the goal line, because trying to repeal a bill once it's law is very, very difficult. But in all reasonableness now, for 8 years, it's all been tangled into the healthcare system of the U.S. A lot of people have seen their expenses go up, but there are other people who are dependent upon it. And the question is, can you detangle a bad law while keeping those things that you need to keep and not hurt people? You can't just say, we repeal and we go back to the way we were. That's not going to sell politically. So the real question is whether this bill will fail, and then will President Trump come in with his own bill? You know, but the Obamacare, just as it was predicted, by the way, was fraught with all of the problems that were predicted, that were poo-pooed and denied at the time. And that's another important lesson. So there are really three lessons out of this whole experience here. Okay, we're going to watch it. I'm going to watch this vote on the Affordable Health Care Act to see which way it goes, because it tells you a lot about politics. And you're right. If you run on a platform, remember George Bush, no new taxes, read my lips. Well, we read his lips and we got new taxes. That was a death knell in the next election.
It was
a killer. And so there were a lot of promises made this last election too. So we'll see where it goes. But it's always great, Ryan. Good time to be in news and in financial news at this time. And I appreciate all the hard work and sweat and blood you put into it.
No worries at all. We'll see you next week, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
On the longer term cycle and where the market is and where the economy is, the shadow Fed funds rate bottomed in May of 2014 at -3%. And this takes into account the QE and Operation Twist and all those other things that the Fed was doing, because it hit that zero bound and couldn't lower rates anymore. And if you go back over the last roughly 35 years or so, the interest rate cycles have gone in roughly 400 basis points swing. So on that math, monetary policy always acts with a lag, always has a lag in its impact. And so a year or so after the final rate hike is when you'd probably start looking for a recession, and that puts you early 2019.
Well, stock markets continue to plow forward, especially after the Fed recently raised interest rates. Does the Trump rally continue? Joining us on the program is John Murphy. He's chief technical analyst at StockCharts.com, and he's also author of the book Trading with Intermarket Analysis. John, you look at the markets from different perspectives. You look at these relationships between asset classes, whether you're looking at stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies. And I wonder if we might start out looking at some of these market relationships, and in particular, stocks and bonds. As you look at that relationship, what are you seeing today?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, if you go back to the election, for example, generally speaking, bond prices and stocks move in opposite directions. Since the election, for example, we've had a really good example of this. We had a tremendous surge of money into stocks since the November 8th election. But that was also accompanied by rising interest rates because people, they got very optimistic on the economy and, you know, more infrastructure spending, inflation, things like that. So the very same factors that push stocks up push bond prices down. So yields go up, bonds go down. And that also, by the way, plays a very important role within the stock market itself. For example, over the last several months, with bond yields going up, certain sectors of the market, for example, do better in that environment. For example, economically sensitive stocks have done very well over the last few months, whereas rate-sensitive stocks like REITs and utilities did very poorly. So even within the stock market, the direction of interest rates not only tells us something about the stock market, but it also tells us where in the stock market you want to be positioned. Yesterday was a very good example, Jim. You know, the Fed raised rates, but the statement was viewed as a little more dovish than, I don't know what people were expecting, but they took it as a little bit more dovish. And instantly we had a sharp drop in bond yields. Okay. We also had a sharp drop in the dollar. Stocks rallied, but if you notice, when the dollar dropped, for example, with bond yields, we saw a tremendous surge of money into gold. Gold does very well when rates are dropping and the dollar is weak. We also saw within the stock market that utilities and REITs were the two strongest. That was just a one-day thing, but it was just a perfect example of that. And even looking around the world, even on a global basis, we noticed that yesterday, foreign stocks rallied very sharply, but emerging markets were up twice as much as developed markets because they are especially sensitive to any hikes in U.S. rates. They're also very influenced by the direction of commodity prices. So the whole point of this is that everything affects everything else. And as a technical analyst, and I am a technical analyst, I still am, but you know, my point is if you're looking at stocks, for example, just the stock market, you sort of have to know what's going on in bonds. You have to know what's going on in the dollar. You have to know which sectors of the market are leading and which ones are weak. And if you're not doing that, you're just leaving too much on the table. You're just ignoring too much valuable information.
All right, let's take, we've saw that stocks and bonds have been trending. In other words, interest rates and stocks trade in the same direction, prices inversely. John, in your first book, Intermarket Analysis, that wasn't necessarily the case. You talk about a couple things changed beginning in, let's say, 1998. I wonder if you'd share that with our listeners in how these relationships have changed over time and also what you think caused that change.
My first Intermarket book was actually written, I think, in 1990, something like that. We were in the middle of a very inflationary period then, and yes, the relationship between bonds and stocks was quite different. The reason I wrote my second book, I think it was 2003, was that the relationships changed. In other words, whereas bonds and stocks previously had moved in the same direction, after 2000, they started moving in opposite directions. And the reason for that is we went into a deflationary environment. The whole last decade has been characterized more by fears of deflation than fears of inflation. And in that environment, it changed the relationship between bonds and stocks so that if you go back and you look at the bear market of 2000, 2007, bond prices went up while stock prices went down. And that has still been the case over the last couple of years. Now, the Federal Reserve and all this quantitative easing, it has distorted things a little bit. You know, it's kept rates artificially low and bond prices too high. I think we may be reaching the point where those yields are starting to move higher, despite what happened yesterday. I do think that the trend of global yields is higher, which is going to be negative for bonds. And I think, at least for the foreseeable future, I think that's going to be positive for the stock market.
Another relationship that also has moved in the same direction, and that is stocks and commodities. So as you look at the stock market with the S&P and the Dow at record levels, let's talk about the relationship to commodities, because we've seen, especially in the last week, we've seen oil prices pull back. And up until yesterday, gold prices were also pulling back. But also, let's talk about two important commodities, oil and copper, in relation to stocks.
What's very interesting, in the past, let's go back a decade, for example. Well, in the business cycle, rising commodity prices are generally good for the economy in the early stages because it's a sign of economic growth and it's a sign that, you know, interest rates are moving up. For example, going into last year, you may recall the beginning of, 2016, commodities were in a free fall. Price of oil was down under $30, as I remember, and that was creating fears of deflation. And you'll notice that stocks and commodities bottomed together last January, February, and throughout last year, they rose together. And I think that was actually a positive thing. So in this environment right now, rising commodity prices are actually a positive for the stock market because it signals, first of all, rising commodity prices are a sign of global strength. The two you mentioned in particular, copper and oil. You'll notice that within the commodity framework, base metals, aluminum, copper, steel, all those things, they have really been surging over the last 6 months. That's a good sign for the global economy, and it's a good sign for the stock market. It's not necessarily a good sign for the bond market. Now, over the last month or two, and I've been a little concerned about this, we did see a big slide in the price of oil, and also we've seen a pullback in base metals like copper. I still think they're both in uptrends. But I think this is just, it's a pullback, and it's had me a little bit concerned. But I think they'll eventually regroup it and start to move back up again. And by the way, they also affect parts of the stock market. Energy stocks are very influenced by the price of oil, and they've been the weakest part of the market this year. And that worries me a little bit. We've also seen a pullback in material stocks. But I think we're probably near the bottom of that right now. I think we're scraping bottom. And here again, the direction of the dollar plays a big role in this. So if you're trading commodities right now, are you trading gold stocks, are you trading copper stocks or energy, you have to see what the dollar is doing and the direction of interest rates. So it's all interrelated, Jim. But the bottom line is that in this environment right now, if there does come a point in the cycle where rising commodity prices really raise inflation and the Fed has to get aggressive, we're nowhere near that. The Fed is welcoming inflation at this point.
Let's stay on the dollar for a bit, because it was widely anticipated prior to the Fed's announcement yesterday where they raised interest rates a quarter of a point that the 10-year Treasury note had got up to close to 2.6%. And the feeling was, well, rising interest rates are good for the dollar. The dollar would rise. But John, on Wednesday, the Fed raises interest rates a quarter of a point. The dollar goes down. Interest rates go down. Commodity prices go up.
Well, that's exactly the way it's supposed to happen. Now, it was a little bit of a surprise in the sense that I think the Fed had telegraphed this so well. And, of course, we did have a big jump in rates over the last month or two. We're up against, the December high. We've been kind of a holding pattern over the last couple of months, and the dollar was bouncing a little bit. I think yesterday it looked to me like the Fed raised rates. Everyone knew they were going to raise rates. So that was priced in. But I think a lot of people were looking for three rate hikes later this year, and the Fed suggested only two. So I think it was a slightly less hawkish than, or a little more dovish than people were looking for. But just taking that one day by itself, everything did exactly what it should do in the sense that bond yields dropped sharply. And normally when that happens and short-term rates drop, the dollar drops because they're very closely correlated. And the combination of falling rates and falling dollar pushed money into gold. So just on a day-to-day basis, it was a perfect example of those intermarket relationships working together.
In your book's intermarket analysis, you talk about a sequence of events that we see play out as we get close to market tops. And let's go back to, let's say, 1999 and 2000 with the bursting of the tech bubble. Typically, you will see oil prices start to rise. As oil prices start to rise, the bond market peaks first. Then the stock market peaks second, and finally,
commodities peaked third, which would go along with the latter part of the business cycle. As the economy's heating up, you're using more commodities. Inflation is heating up, so the Fed is raising interest rates. Here we are now. The Fed is raising interest rates. We've seen commodity prices move up since bottoming out, let's say, last February. Do you see any signs of that sequence starting to play out today?
Jim, I think we're in the very early stages of that. I do think bond prices have peaked, okay? But again, a lot of this is the Fed and things like that. But basically speaking, commodities bottomed last year. And normally a commodity bottom will coincide with the bond peak. So I do think commodity prices have bottomed, and I do think that bond prices have peaked. But I think we're in the very early stages. So let's assume, let's take it in sequence. Let's assume bond prices have peaked and the 30-year bull market in bonds is over. The money coming out of bonds moves into stocks, and we've been seeing that. Generally speaking, money that comes out of the bond market generally flows into stocks. That's why over the last 5 or 6 months, you've seen them moving in opposite directions. Part of the thing driving stocks higher is our commodities. It means that commodity prices are reviving. So after bonds peak, normally what happens is stocks stay strong, and then commodities really start to take off. Commodities, generally speaking, in the long-term cycle, are the last group to really turn up, okay? That becomes a problem. Oil, take oil as an example. Every recession we've had in the last 40 years has been preceded by a spike in the price of oil, which has caused the Fed to raise rates aggressively, and that has caused a bear market in stocks. But we're nowhere near that phase yet. I think we're in the very early stages. Bonds are peaking. I don't think stocks are close to peaking, and commodities are just really starting to turn up. So we may be a year or two away. I shouldn't give time frame. It won't really become a problem until commodity prices really surge to the point where the Federal Reserve gets concerned and then starts to raise rates aggressively. But I don't think we're anywhere near that at this particular point. So that money coming out of bonds, a lot of it's going into stocks, a lot of it's going into commodities. But in the stock market, a lot of the money is going into commodity-related stocks, which I think is probably the best way for most people to play that. I'm a big fan of exchange-traded funds. You have a gold ETF, you have a copper ETF. You know what I'm saying? The stock's tied to those sectors. So I think those would be good places to be. In an inflationary environment, stocks tied to commodities are generally a good place to be.
So let's talk about the role that oil plays in that. It bottomed last February, and then oil prices literally doubled. In the last week or so, John, we've seen oil prices pull back very sharply. So as you look at commodities, let's assume that, let's say, bonds have peaked, but we would start to see stocks continue to do well and also commodity prices start to rise. So as you look at the price of oil, the price of copper, do you think this is just a corrective period that we're going through now and you would expect that to continue upward along with the business cycle?
Yes, I do think that's the case. Of course, that's assuming that rates don't rise too far too fast. But yeah, I do think we're in a holding. Copper is just in a relatively minor pullback. I do follow the base metals very, very closely. Not gold. Gold really has a whole different role in this. But base metals, I think we're in a correction. And by the way, the Chinese market has a lot to do with that. Whenever we talk about base metals in particular or commodities, we always look at China because China is the world's biggest buyer of commodities. So the stock market and conditions in China, which are starting to look a lot better, are also very important. I noticed the Chinese government raised rates yesterday also right after we did, and that's a sign of optimism. So things are getting better in China as well, so I always keep an eye on that. Oil, I think the same thing. Oil doubled in price, and as you know, one of the rules of technical analysis, as you're probably aware, is whenever something doubles, it's not a bad idea to take some profits. Right now, in fact, I just wrote an article on this a couple of days ago. If you look at the long-term price of oil, this looks to me like we're in a pullback. We've basically been in a trading range at this particular point. So, yeah, I do think it's a pullback in and ongoing. Now, oil is a little more complicated because it has to do with OPEC and production and things like that. But by and large, yes, I do think this is a pullback in commodities and oil in particular. In fact, I think the market's getting to the point, I think we're pretty close to the bottom here.
Sometimes when you're analyzing a commodity, it also helps to analyze the stocks. And one of the things I noticed, John, in, let's say, the last couple of months, you've had the price of the commodity, whether gold was rising, but the stocks were falling. The price of oil was rising, but the price of the oil stocks were falling. Was that signaling this correction and weakness, in your opinion? you're very astute in noticing that. A lot of people don't notice that. I don't have a good explanation why this is true, but the stocks tend to lead the commodities. Gold is a perfect example. We have an ETF that trades gold mining stocks, GDX, gold mining shares. Several months ago, one of the reasons I turned bullish on gold was that gold stocks turned up. And then over the last few weeks, I noticed gold stocks were turning down. Gold stocks tend to lead gold higher on the upside and lead it on the downside. Same thing is true with oil. The oil spider, XLE, and I follow these very closely. Very often, they will lead turns. Now, right now, for example, the XLE has also sold off, but it's sitting right at its 200-day moving average, which, as you know, was a very, very important support point. So, and they're very oversold. So if the XLE, which is the spider of oil stocks, the energy sector, if that holds at its 200-day moving average, that in itself could be signaling a bottom in the price of oil. So here again, if you're an oil trader, if you're a commodity trader, you have to see what the stocks are doing. And if you're a stock trader, you have to look at the commodities are doing. The old days of just looking at one market, you just can't do that anymore.
So as we take a look at these relationships and the sequence of these asset classes peaking, we talked about the possibility that bonds have already peaked. So we would expect, number one, stocks to continue to do well, commodity prices continue to rise. Let's talk about what that means for sector rotation, because as the business cycle goes through its various phases, and as we head towards the end of a business cycle, there's going to be a rotation in different sectors within the S&P. What are you seeing take place there?
Well, we've already seen this. I mean, really, this latest rotation really began after the election in November. Let's put it this way. Let's go back to the current situation. If I'm reading this right, and the stock market's going up in commodities, stocks tied to the economy should do very well, like a consumer discretionary stocks, industrial stocks, even material stocks, because they're very closely tied to the price of commodities. I have to throw technology in there. Those are the groups that should be the leaders. The groups that will lag behind, if rates do go up and bonds go down, the bond proxies, we call them, dividend-paying stocks like utilities, REITs, even to an extent consumer staples, they should be the ones that should underperform. So you have to sort of position yourself for stocks that do better in a rising rate climate and a stronger stock market. And I've already mentioned commodities, material stocks, energy stocks. So you want to start skewing as you're moving out of the bond market. And if you think commodities are moving up, which I think is the case, you have to increase your exposure to commodities as well. And also on a global basis, I've already tossed this in, as far as foreign stocks are concerned, in the climate of rising commodity prices, emerging markets do extremely well because they are Russia, Brazil, and there are several others. These are big commodity exporters. So that's why emerging markets this year have outperformed developed markets. Even in that sense, globally, emerging markets are doing very well in that climate. So I think those are my favorite groups right now.
So as we talked about some of the divergence that we've seen in probably the last couple of weeks, the difference between gold and gold stocks, oil and oil stocks, as I'm looking at my charts today, I'm seeing that the GDX is rising again, and you've got a bump up in XLE. Would you want to see those confirm that trend that commodities are in an uptrend?
Yeah, and the canary in the coal mine there are the stocks. In fact, even yesterday, I was writing a little clip at the end of the day. Gold had a big jump yesterday. The stocks were up 5%. Gold stocks are up 5%. Oh, I noticed gold's up again today. Yes, those are the groups that I would expect to see. I have to admit, because gold is in sort of a class by itself, I'm a little more focused on energy and base metals, because in a stronger economy, those are where the money is going. Gold to a lesser extent, because if you're in a climate of rising rates, which I think we're in, and if stocks stay strong, which I also assume is the case, it may go up, but it's not the commodity area I would focus on. I'd focus on the more economically sensitive areas like the base metals, like copper and aluminum, steel stocks very strong today, and energy. Those are the groups that I would really focus on, maybe gold to a lesser extent. But yes, you want to see the buying in the ETFs, the XLE, the GDX, the COPX, which is copper miners.
So if I was following this commodity trend, looking for the sequence that you talk about in intermarket relationships, I'd be watching copper, I would be watching the CRB, I'd be watching oil prices.
And if they continue to tick upwards, then this sequence is playing out as most intermarket relationships do.
Yeah, I think so. I do lean in that direction. And I think this sell-off is just, like I said, oil is a big driver here. After doubling in price, normally you get a pullback, and it's not that much of a pullback. If you look at the chart over the last year, we've barely even come down a third of the way, which is really perfectly normal. So At the moment, I lean toward the view that this is fairly temporary, and in fact, this might be a good time to start looking at some of those commodity stocks again.
And finally, John, if there was something that was to concern you about the direction of the market, what would that be?
I would say probably the dollar. The dollar is kind of a wild card in this. If the dollar were to really take off from here, and I do think the dollar will trend higher, but if it really takes off from here, that would make it difficult for commodity prices to really turn up, because one of the most consistent intermarket relationships, and this very rarely changes, is that the dollar moves in the opposite direction of most commodities. So if you'll notice, the dollar's been down the last couple of days, which is why commodities have been up. If the dollar really were to take off here and really strengthen, that could make a rally in commodities more difficult, and that would also hurt emerging markets and other things. But I think from everything that I'm seeing from the Fed and everything else, they're going to move very gradually here, very gradually. So I don't think there'll be any surprises. And by the way, since we're talking about the Fed, I have to point out that, like I mentioned, the Chinese have raised interest rates. I think this period of quantitative easing is over. Global yields have clearly bottomed. If you look at the German bonds and even the Japanese and the Brits, they're moving up. They're moving up much more slowly than ours. But I think we're near the end of that. And there's even talk about the ECB, the European, maybe raising rates later this year. And once that happens, that will close the gap between U.S. rates and foreign rates, and I think that will slow the rise of the dollar. But the dollar could be a wild card in here.
Well, John, as we close, would you mind telling our listeners about StockCharts.com? It's one of my favorite technical charting programs. But tell our listeners what they're going to find there.
Well, the problem with StockCharts has got too much, I think. It's a very easy site. In fact, we like people to take a look at it. In fact, you can do a lot of stuff free on the site. There's a lot of stuff you can just get involved. But it's just a great charting site. And for people who are new, for example, there's the chart school there. It walks you through everything. There are a lot of tutorials and things like that. But everything is there. Of course, you can chart anything you want. All the indicators are there. You can do a lot of intermarket analysis. But what I also like about it is that it breaks down a lot of things for you. For example, there's a sector page you can look at, which has become one of my favorites. On any given day, in fact, as soon as we get off the phone, I'm going to go do this. And on any different day, they'll show you the 10 sectors, and they'll say which sectors are up and which sectors are down in that order. And then you can click to the sector, like take a leading sector, and it will tell you, it'll break it down into, say, 9 or 10 groups within that sector. For example, just last week, I happened to look and I noticed that the consumer discretionary sector was the strongest sector of the day. And when I clicked on it, I saw the home builders were the top sector within that. So I took a look at that chart and it was just starting to break out. So I wrote a very positive article on home building stocks. And then you can even click down further and find out which stocks are leading. So it breaks the market down. It tells you what's up, what's down. And it makes it very easy to isolate where the strength is and where the weakness is in the market. And it tells you something about the market itself also. So there are a lot of tools in there. And, you know, I really think that if someone is looking for a site, and then, by the way, if you're an experienced technical, I know a lot of experienced people use it. There's just a lot in there. And I would certainly encourage those who are looking for a site, at least check it out, StockCharts.com.
One of your favorite sections is called Major Markets. And on one page, I've got major markets, the indexes, the different sectors, the industry indexes. Then I have international ETFs. And then I have a whole section on bonds, commodities, and currencies all on one page. So if you want to look all over the world, any asset class, it's right there.
And it's funny because I start the day with that. It's called the Market Summary page. They'll show you all the major indexes, all the sub-indexes, bonds, commodities, foreign stock. So you can tell at a glance, and there's usually a theme to it. And you can see where the strength is, where the weakness is, and it sort of makes sense. And just in that one snapshot, I turn that on every morning. I wait about a half an hour for the markets. Some of the ETFs take a little while to open up. And you can just, glancing at that, see where the strength is. And it really tells you a lot about what's going on that given day.
that makes things so much easier. You know, the market seemed like there's so much noise going on. It seems so noisy and confusing. But you look at things like that and you realize it's not that confusing. You know, there's usually a theme to it. And tools like that make it a lot easier to figure that out.
Well, it's my favorite page. I do the same thing. That's the first thing I look at when I get up in the morning. John, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. The name of the site is called StockCharts.com, and I would invite you to go check it out and look at it. Some great, great stuff on the site. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Jim. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Cameron Sorsby. He's Chief Operating Officer of a company called Praxis. You know, Cameron, when I saw one of your founders on television talking about what you were doing, it reminded me of sort of the apprentice programs that we used to have in the 14th century when we had medieval guilds where you took somebody, you put them through a training program, and then they were apprenticed, and then eventually they had a full-paying job or skill set. Tell our listeners a little bit about Praxis, because you're breaking the mold of education and work.
Yes, absolutely, Jim. And thanks for having me on. So Praxis, it's a 9-month apprenticeship program, and we are connecting high quality young talent, anywhere from 18 to 25 year olds, to high growth businesses, usually tech startups. And, you know, how the program works is these participants are coming in. They've signaled to us, we have a thorough application process, and I can talk about what we look for. But essentially, they are going into these high growth companies in sales, marketing, operations roles, and they are learning by doing. Our theory is the best way, just like the old apprenticeship model, the best way to learn a specific skill, trade, or more importantly, to be that kind of entrepreneurial value creator in today's professional world, you need to start doing it. So that's the real name of the game for us. We're kind of taking our participants. We provide some initial training and development and continued education to help them along. But they're really taking the lead by going into these full-time roles and creating value.
Well, it's certainly been an interesting market since the election. We have stock prices at record levels, but we also have rising interest rates. On the day that we are starting this interview, the Fed is set to raise interest rates for the third time. Joining me is my good friend Don Cox from Don Cox Advisors. Don, let's talk about what's going on with interest rates. We hit an all-time record low last summer around 1.3%. We're currently close to 2.6. We've had rising interest rates. We have a Fed on the day you and I are speaking is widely expected to raise rates for the third time. And now we have rising yields in the U.S. that are higher in some of the more riskier countries in the world. A lot of this doesn't make sense. I'd like to get your perspective.
You're absolutely right. If we take sort of the bookends on this with the 10-year Treasury at 260 and Italy at 231, but Germany is 0.42. I mean, even, you know, Britain's yields are 1, 2, 3. So what we have is with the Fed, we're now told that there could be, you know, 2 or even 3 more rate hikes this year because the Fed is behind the curve. And yet the stock market is up 50 points again today. And so what we have is a combination of enthusiasm and near euphoria in the stock market. But the bond market is saying that there's a lot of risk here. And certainly the spreads and yields are something that cannot be helping Donald Trump's idea of improving the U.S. trade deficit.
You know, the thing that really strikes me is you have a president. We are, what, 7 or 8 years into this business cycle, which is a longer cycle than normal, typically at this end of the cycle, you don't normally see a great emphasis to bring in stimulus as the president's talking about. He's talking about lowering taxes, infrastructure spending. At the same time, we have the Federal Reserve that's saying we're going to raise interest rates. Are these two opposing policies going to be in conflict, and who wins, the president or the Fed?
Well, an irresistible force meeting an immovable object, and you can label whichever one of them you want, is something that is a classic contrast. So for investors, if you know that this is the thing, which is that the Fed pretty much has to keep raising rates with the inflationary pressures developing, but Trump determined to run up the deficit, but most importantly, to improve the U.S. trade position. And look, 3 years ago, the DXY was at 79. It's at 101 now. Think about that. The huge drop in the value, particularly of the euro in that time, and of course the pound, and the drop in the value of the Mexican peso, so that what we have is a policy that says we got to undo the unfairnesses on the U.S. trade position. And there's no question about it that the big unfairness is that most other countries have a way of making sure that their exports are not subject to government taxes, so that therefore, in effect, there's a subsidy. So that's being addressed in this policy that they're talking about doing with the Republicans in Congress. But we're talking about such gigantic differences in valuation coexisting with each other. And you and I both know that when you have variations seeming to be wildly apart, there's going to be a resolution of it one way or the other. And it's the kind of thing that cautious people say, I'd like to sort of get out of the way of this.
Yeah, because when you take a look at this, you know, the night before the election, we had the Dow down 800 points, and then it's been going up ever since. And a lot of this, Don, is based on things that may happen, but if they do happen, it may be a considerable time before they have an effect. For example, tax cuts, the repeal of Obamacare, infrastructure spending, deregulation. And we know that, for example, even under President Obama, when they passed infrastructure spending, after almost 3 or 4 years after it was passed, they only had spent 3/4 of it. So the market is moving up, to me, on a lot of euphoria and hope. And what are the chances that all of these things could get done in one single year? Certainly, they're going to be Herculean tasks.
The one thing that could be done this year on schedule would be the deregulation. And according to Neil Ferguson, that was the single biggest contributor to why it was that the Obama recovery never really got underway, despite the low interest rates and the Fed stimulus. And so the problem there is, of course, can they appoint anybody into these jobs to get it done? Because they're being held up in Congress. But that's, other than that, you're absolutely right. Certainly replacing Obamacare, as we see, is something that is threatening to tear the Republican Party apart. And doing a revision of its trade policies with its leading trading partners is not something that gets done overnight. So it's one of these situations where we have a huge amount of anticipation for which people are paying heavily in order to be part of the way it's going to turn out. I can't recall, frankly, a time like this where there was such a spread between the pessimism in Europe and the optimism in the United States at a time when the EU, their economic growth is almost identical now to U.S. economic growth, and their prospects, if they can get through these elections this year, would be at least as good as the U.S. So it's one of these things where if somehow or other this enthusiasm starts to wane, I have a feeling that It's like the ice breaking in Lake Superior in the spring.
Yeah, it's amazing because when you look at the market, it is going up and you start looking at our earnings driving it. Is economic growth driving it? Certainly, you can't say that economic growth has been stellar. You certainly can't say that earnings, which have improved, are stellar as well. So there usually has to be something concrete longer term that's going to drive stock prices higher. Do you see that possibility, or do you think this is one of those markets that maybe needs to take a break or is at risk of a severe correction?
Well, the thing is that there may be money coming into the U.S. stock market from abroad simply to take a bet on the dollar, because the dollar is the only currency out there of, you know, sizable currency that at the moment looks to be in a bull market phase, with the possible exception of, say, India. China's trying to protect their currency, but as far as the U.S. trading partners, Canada's economy is so heavily oriented towards the oil industry and the gas industry, and that's in a tetchy situation. And then you've got Mexico, their currency has been depreciated, and the euro, and that makes up a huge part of the U.S. trade apart from the China situation, and we're going to see 2 days down in Florida negotiating that one.
So as you take a look at this, I mean, we're talking about almost a complete regime change in Washington. If you compare, let's say, the policies of Donald Trump compared to, let's say, his predecessor, Barack Obama, we're talking about deregulation versus heavy regulation, lower taxes versus higher taxes, renegotiating trade deals that would be more favorable to the U.S. So you're talking about a different kind of market that would respond to that. I mean, if you were looking at what you would think if you had to make one investment today or a series of investments and leave them alone for the next 8 years, what would that be?
That's a really great question, because I'm sure that's what the pension fund committees are looking at now because of the capital asset pricing model, where the benchmark used in the model is the 10-year treasury. And since its yield is so high compared to almost all the other yields that are out there, then the question is, when you look at equities, U.S. equities in comparison, where the U.S., the multiple on U.S. equities is near an all-time high, and then if you start to look at equities in Europe, you've got the political risks. So you look at a situation where the pension fund committee is, let's say they're trying to get 7.5% returns. Where can you go for jam? And that is, I think, the pension fund crisis in this country is going to be, I believe, over the next 2 years, the single biggest problem that the nation is going to have to face, because it's been pushed off and off and off. But because of these high valuations out there, then even if we get the economic growth that Trump's talking about, even if we get 3% economic growth, well, the market is basically paying for that right now.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you take a look at, I think this is probably the second or third most expensive stock market in history. And we all know, Don, contrary to sometimes what the media will tell us, I can remember in 2000 when we thought the new economy was going to make us all rich and go on forever. Likewise, in 2007, you and I were all going to get rich owning rental real estate, and it turned out much different than what anybody anticipated. So when you have returns this high, they almost imply going forward the returns are going to be lower.
This is the problem. And you see, I think it's partly demographically driven, because what you have is of U.S. savings in the private sector outside the pension funds, they're hugely for people of 50 years and over in age. And so it used to be, of course, that you simply got more heavily weighted in bonds for income. But then when the bonds stopped giving you the kind of income that you needed, you said, well, I've got to do my own capital asset pricing model and go more deeply into equities. And because the dividend at one stage was the stage where you had higher yields in a reasonable portfolio of stocks, but that was higher than you were getting on the 10-year Treasury. But now what we got is a situation where there's nothing that you can buy that's not really speculative, that it forces you going into the junk bond market, and even that market now is very expensive. But I believe it's because that the combination of the pension funds and the over 50s that collectively are pricing the market, and that's basically saying, in the case of the pension funds, they got to try and meet that elusive 7, and for the retired people, they're saying, well, we need this much income. So it's something where demography then, I believe, is the unseen driving force of why this valuation is occurring. But if the decisions are being made collectively by the over 70s, then what we know is that's a short-term play by definition.
Yeah, yeah, I want to get back to this issue that you're raising, that the pension crisis, because I see this almost daily in the retirement market. And Robert Merton, who I had on the show recently, thinks it's one of the biggest crises in this country that we're going to face, just as you just mentioned. And he brought up an issue that I think really drives home the point. Had you had $1 million in the year 2000, Don, you could have got between 60, 70, maybe a little more, $1,000 a year in income that was fairly safe. And I'm talking about 10-year treasuries, 2-year treasuries. Today, if you were to invest that $1 million in the same kind of safe securities, a 2-year treasury, you'd be getting $13,000. And I mean, think of the implications for somebody that's retired, thought they saved a substantial amount of money, as $1 million would be, and now their income prospects are very dim compared to where they were 17 years ago.
You were talking about an impoverished millionaire.
Who would have ever thought?
Yeah, that's the point. And I came into this business basically from the pension fund side. And so the result was that I started off learning about the bond markets as being, because back at that time, you were getting 14 and 15% on treasuries, let alone good corporates. But what we've seen is we've had this sustained bond market, bull market, which has hammered down the rates there, and yet it did not deliver the economic growth on the other side. I mean, if you and I have been talking 12 years ago and said, we're going to have a period of time where the U.S. yield is going to be between 1 and 2%, you say, well, that must mean it's in recession. Say, oh, no, no, it was actually not in recession. You say, well, then what did people do for income? And that's exactly it. So now when they're talking, I mean, we're looking at the crisis for the Social Security, because with the short duration of the short of assets in the Social Security Trust Fund, they aren't even getting anything like the yield on the 10-year Treasury. So it's something, though these politicians are not talking about it. I appeared before the U.S. Congressional Committee on the Social Security Trust Fund back in the 90s at their behest because of my work with the Canada Pension Plan. And when I went through and analyzed why it was that the fact that they were going short duration on the bonds and the fund, why this was a bad policy, because we were a bond bull market, and it meant that as you rolled over your funds, you were going to get lower and lower returns. And it became such a violent debate, actually, with the committee that I was actually ordered to step down from the platform. They called me back, then we went through it. And I was told by the chairman of the committee, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, that both political parties were in on it, that they were, by having short duration, they were reducing the national deficit for that year. They were systematically hurting the future of Social Security. So now we're in this position where the yield in the Social Security Trust Fund is ridiculously low, and therefore they can't postpone very much longer, having to vastly increase the contribution to that fund. But because both parties are part of it, what you don't have is a situation where anybody is standing up and saying, you are at blame. When everybody's all to blame, it means there's going to be no solution.
You know, it's amazing, because when rates came down after the Great Recession, most homeowners, if you could afford to refinance, you refinanced your mortgage. You would be surprised that the government, recognizing that we're looking at the lowest interest rates that we've seen in human history, would want to lock in on 30-year bonds at these low rates to put them on a sound basis. But a lot of the government's debt, as you just mentioned, is short-term, from Social Security to outstanding treasuries.
Absolutely. And as I say, the reason why you never don't read about it is because neither political party dares to come out and say, we had an opportunity, in the case when the Republicans were in power, to extend the duration. We didn't do it because we knew it would add to the deficits for each year. And so what we've got is, this is the one thing that you can say, that everybody is in on the situation, and therefore the situation can only get worse, because nobody can win political gains by saying, see, you did it wrong. So that, as far as I'm concerned, is why it is that what the Fed is doing is therefore the only group that can do something to increase the yield of the Social Security Trust Fund is the Federal Reserve. And so when people are saying, well, you're raising rates and that's going to hurt the economy, the one thing that wins from that is the Social Security Trust Fund plus the retired people who are now going to get a higher income. But because they are not one of the two political parties, they can do what's right.
You know, as you look at this, you mentioned you grew up or came into this industry from pensions and the bond market. You take a look at the markets today. You've got two different markets that are telling us a different story. The stock market is rising to euphoric levels, second highest level we've seen in the history. And you have the bond market whose yields are rising. One of those markets are going to be right. If I had to make a bet, I would say I would bet on the bond market. They tend to be more right than the stock market.
Absolutely, because the bond market is okay, even if the bond yields do go up. The fact remains that you are, as your portfolio rolls over, you're gradually increasing your income by buying them. Whereas if the stock market goes down, you don't automatically improve your situation by buying a falling stock market. That's a huge difference people don't notice between when they say, well, the bond market's risky here because the Fed is raising rates. The risk in the bond market is minuscule compared to the risk in the stock market when we've got all these other factors plus a worse geopolitical situation in terms of what liabilities the U.S. has to deal with right now in Asia and sending more troops back out to the Middle East. I mean, when you look at all of those things out there, those are things which could lead to bad stock market results, but they conversely could lead to good bond market results. So I think that the lesson that your listeners need to really look at is not to be told, well, this is a bad time to buy bonds. To say, well, the amount of money you can lose on the bond market is, as I say, infinitesimal. The stock market, if we were to have a breakout of a war in Asia, or if we have the German election going the wrong way, or if we have real problems along the Mexican border, there's a whole number of things which are extraneous to the ordinary valuation of the stock market, but they're things that when they happen badly hit the stock market. None of those things do damage to bonds. That's the odd part of it. The bond market, if fear develops, the bond market, you actually win in it. I think this is a case where if you got a choice between fear and greed, the stock market right now is the greed. The bond market is showing fear of the Fed. Well, in the past, fear of the Fed didn't hurt you as much as failing to see a political crisis such as what happened back in the 70s when we had the Arab invasion. So more and more people were looking at the relative rates of risk, saying where it is. And in the meantime, you're being paid with the bonds to sit with them.
Well, Don, as we close, if you had to choose right now, I think you just stated it, there's two things going on in the market, fear on the bond side, greed on the stock market. This might be the time to choose fear over greed.
That's right. But I think what people also have to look at is that there is another kind of fear, which is geopolitical fear. And I think there's only one asset class that you can put in there to protect yourself against that. And I think that's precious metals. So I think that no matter what else you do, you've got to make sure you maintain some exposure into that sector. Because the world is more unpredictable now than it has been in decades in terms of big, big events. And those are the kinds of things where, as we saw what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine, when we looked like Greece was going to default and break apart the euro, in each case, the only thing that you really won on was gold and silver and the stocks of those companies. So that's something outside where you build in extra protection. This is a case in which you buy against fear of the unknown. We've been talking now about fear of the known. The fear of the unknown is best handled, I believe, by having exposure to gold and silver and the mining companies.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Don, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, how could they do so?
They can go to the Cox Advisors website, and we are starting a new podcast product, and we'll start to post that very shortly, and it reflects the kinds of views. See, it's so easy to talk to you because I never find that I have to argue with you. I because sometimes I'm talking to people who are big names out there, and they get really upset with me for saying these things. So it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program. All the best, sir.
And to you.
Back in 2002, Jim Poplava did an article called The Next Big Thing, and we predicted the next big shift was going to be into commodities, largely gold, precious metals, and oil. And following that, we did a series called Power Shift Series on War and Oil. So these were trends that Jim foresaw back in the early part of the 2000s. Now we're in another mega trend change. We did mega trends over the last couple of weeks, and now we're into some big changes in which the bull market in bonds is over. So what does that mean? And the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point this week. So what does that all mean anyway? Is it important or not important? And the market's reaction to it seemed a little strange. All of that coming up next as a subject of conversation on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.